It's 5:24, and you're listening to No One Is Legal Radio, a show about the frontline resistance and struggles for dignity and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're a part of the CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're currently joined in the studio with Dark Matter, who are performing as the keynote for Cooper McGill's Culture Shock series tomorrow evening in Montreal. Dark Matter is a trans South Asian art and activist collaboration comprised of Janani and Alec. Using poetry and polemic, tweet and tirade, Dark Matter is committed to an art practice of gender self-determination, racial justice, and movement building. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having us.
To begin, I'm going to let you two introduce yourselves to the listeners.
Sure. My name is Janani. I'm one half of Dark Matter and a nerd.
My name is Alok, and I'm the other half of Dark Matter and also a nerd, but I think more in more denial than Janani.
I'm out of the nerd closet. Nerd library.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your current tour, It Gets Bitter?
Sure. So Alok and I started touring, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
2 years ago. And our names are Janani Balasubramanian and Alok Vadmenon, which is too long to fit on a flyer. So we came up with the name Dark Matter and went on a ridiculous tour our first time where we were doing a city a day. But now we do this much calmer thing where we travel, in less frequent spurts. But our current tour is based on a lot of the issues we talk about in general, which is race, gender, sexuality, anti-colonial movements, anti-racist movements, humor, love, heartbreak, trauma, digestion.
Totally digestion.
Yeah.
So it's called It Gets Bitter, which is a sort of campy take on the It Gets Better project, which, for those of you who don't know, is the white supremacist neoliberal adultist project, which is basically a bunch of older white cis wealthy gay men telling queer youth that somehow it will get better if they magically move to the big city and get a lot of money. And the reason we are calling It Gets Bitter is because I think we're part of a generation of queer young people, specifically of queer people of color, who are kind of angry and fed up with what gets called a gay movement, which is really just a bunch of white men jerking one another off.
So yeah, a lot of our work is spoken word, but we also share and publish work in the form of essays. We put funny photos on the internet. Yeah, we like making art in different forms. We make experimental noise music when we're on tour just to get the creative juices flowing.
Maybe to expand on that, the critiques that Dark Matter has offered on LGBT rights have been incredibly nuanced and influential. Can you talk a little bit about that complex analysis of gender, sexuality, and race that your work is grounded upon?
Sure.
Totally. So most people, when they start talking about what we call the gay movement, begin it in the U.S. with a moment in 1969 called the Stonewall Rebellion. And if they're sort of sophisticated enough to say that this was a riot against police brutality, they'll mark this as the moment of what we call the contemporary gay movement. But what they won't actually tell you is that the people who were fighting at Stonewall and the people who initiated the combat at Stonewall were largely low-income, trans and gender nonconforming people of color, specifically trans women of color, many of whom had compromised living situations, were involved in the underground sex trades, etc. And this history has been whitewashed, wealthwashed, ciswashed to fit into an agenda around pride that somehow says that it used to be bad and now it's getting better. But what we sort of are trying to say is that actually this moment of Stonewall was not part of the gay movement, that the gay movement has hijacked this moment in the service of its neoliberal agenda. For us, this is part of the longer history of people resisting the state's criminalization of our genders and sexualities, a history that we see beginning with the colonial project. And sort of Dark Matter's analysis is very inspired by the idea that homophobia and transphobia and the gender binary and all these systems were imported and enforced on people of color and indigenous people and black people by various systems of colonialism. And that unless we recognize that we are doing decolonization work when we're doing our gender and sexuality work, we run the risk of just pinkwashing. And pinkwashing is another really integral part of our work, which is this idea that currently LGBT rights are in vogue. And a lot of liberals, specifically white upper class liberals, will have an analysis of same-sex marriage, but not about the prison industrial complex, and somehow think that they're progressive because they support gay rights. But for us, gay rights are wrong. They're inextricably linked to histories and continued moments of racial and economic control.
How do you conceive of the relationship between your art and struggles for self-determination, racial justice, and social movements?
I think when we started making art together, and perhaps also, I guess, making art individually, because we do also practice as individual artists, we were making art from a place of just not seeing ourselves represented. And representation is a huge part of being able to, you know, be on at the table talking about these things at all. Right, we didn't see queer, trans, South Asians widely recognized or known as artists. But then also there's this other piece about how do you tell your story without necessarily appropriating or oppressing somebody else's story, which is always constantly the struggle of being a political artist, an artist who is committed to building movements that are for people that we've come to recognize ourselves as part of, but also people that we want to operate in solidarity with. So we see our art as speaking to and from our experience as trans South Asians, trans Indians located in the United States, but with the hope that we are also speaking to the historical privileges that we've inherited, the ways that our communities have been oppressing other communities. So it's not just a story of, oh, I'm victimized because I'm a trans South Asian, but also these are the ways that I have done harm to others, or my identity is built on the repression of other peoples. I think also, it was great to hear this piece about science fiction and Afrofuturism that went up just before ours, because a lot of my work also is inspired by and informed by thinking about how to dismantle and wreck our models of space and time as part of undoing systems of oppression that colonial projects and colonial histories rely on continual erasure. And that continual erasure means that you are always focusing on the present versus the past and the future. And there's something really powerful about amplifying, I guess, the signals of the past and the future when you're doing your work.
I think just to add also on how we see our art informing our political work is that I feel like in a lot of social movement spaces, there's this rehearsal of a politics of respectability and a politics of professionalism that sort of offers this idea that we're 9-to-5 activists and that somehow our political work is just that work and labor. And I think it cleaves this distinction between our political selves and our personal selves. And I think the way that we see our art making intervention is to recognize, how do we acknowledge that the way that our political work harms us and does violence to us as well? How do we acknowledge that we come with all of our trauma, all of our hurt, all of our desire, all of our horniness into our political work? And art, I think, allows us to tease out and explore and interrogate those intersections between the personal and political in a way that I think is fundamentally detrimental to the idea of like being a professional activist, because we carry and inhabit all of these sites of trauma and rupture.
I think also this year we've encountered and been moving through more mainstream art spaces than perhaps we expected to. And so we knew that art, the art world is governed by white people with money. But I think we're learning that very at a more intimate level. And so we're trying to figure out the world we're fighting for is not one in which there is a stage or a gallery, and those are the spaces in which we experience culture, and those are the spaces in which culture are restrained and put on a pedestal, but actually one in which people are able to have fundamentally fewer attacks on their everyday humanity and livelihood that enable them to be part of cultural making and transformation processes. So there isn't a person who's called an artist and a person who's made to be the viewer, or even perhaps not the viewer, people who don't have access to, you know, culture and cultural making spaces, but one in which that process and those spaces are more freely available.
just to piggyback up on that, because this is what we always do. I think what we're also really trying to think about, and we're still struggling with as well, is like, as people committed to a world without borders, and as people committed to an abolitionist framework, what does it mean for us to do art in an abolitionist framework? And I think for us, that's really about decentering us from the idea of dark matter. We really want to allow spaces for other queer and trans artists of color, specifically Black and Indigenous people, to be able to also have the stage, right? So I think one of the things we're always thinking about is, how do we use art as a way to inject and sort of like be a mosquito biting around in social movements, but then also learn how to step back and allow other people to also be artists? Because I think what we're really trying to do is abolish this idea of the artist, that we're just sort of doing our creative work, but everyone else is doing creative work too. But we're called artists because we fit into white categories in ways that other people don't.
It's really interesting that you picked the mosquito, because the mosquito takes blood as feminized labor.
That was a lot.
Yeah, I tried.
How do you see your work going beyond the university setting?
So this is something we always think about a lot, because I think it's really important for us to name that we both went to elite universities, and that informs and is totally apparent in our work. And I think that's largely why a lot of people have had access to us, because we've had access to, in the US, it's like a very politically charged issue, the private university system. So one of the things we really try to do is, when we're on tour, we try to build relationships with local community organizing groups to do writing workshops, creative workshops, and help sort of do that community building around our art. And it's less necessarily about the university event and more about the relationships that we build with our activists. Two, we write a lot about what we call like trolling. And trolling is our way of sort of inhabiting these university spaces to sort of get money, funding, prestige, status, resources, and redistribute that back to the people. Because our analysis is that everything that the university offers as new or cutting edge is actually stolen from poor people and people of color. And so what we're really trying to do is like class ascendant, elite educated people of color, is to do that work of redistribution. How do we use these spaces that we have access to actually leverage on behalf of our peoples?
How do you navigate the limits of using a colonial language to explore themes of colonialism and heteropatriarchy?
Oh God, you're really going for those questions. All right, let's go for and come for English right now. I think, yeah, Lulz. For sure, English is a colonizing language. It was invented and always intended to be a space of hurt and violence. And I think that becomes most apparent to me when I'm trying to have conversations with people in my life who grew up speaking primarily other languages. And I don't know, trying to, especially like academic English, or the English that I was schooled into, literally schooled into, becomes one that doesn't literally does not speak to the people that I'm trying to reach in sort of those intimate ways. And I think that, on the other hand, I guess we have to like acknowledge that, because English has had such a colonizing impact and effect all over the world, it does give us like a immediate access to a lot of privilege and visibility to be able to produce and talk about Global South issues in English.
Yeah, I think this is like a really hard question that's not just about our art, but also what it means for us to be located in diaspora and to continue to profit from exploitation of people in South Asia. Because I think there's a way in which colonialism also, and particularly the ways that it affects our diaspora, sort of separates us from the political dynamics and structures that actually facilitated our own diaspora, specifically caste. And that English is like part of that project, and that it's not just sort of like white people who were like, speak English. It was also like upper caste Brahmins that were like, hey, you don't actually need to learn these indigenous languages that are spoken by Dalit and lower caste people in South Asia. So we totally grapple with these, but I also want to sort of interject and say, I feel like part of also the issue is, if we only locate our communication methods in language, we're not actually capturing what we're totally doing. I think we think of our art as a composite of language, of aesthetics, of gesture, of moments, of all different sort of stylistic choices. And so
selfies,
which is why we put gender's selfie determination in our bios.
Hint.
we think about our performance as not just about language. It's about all these other different forms. So we find that there are ways to have points of access, even if people aren't understanding the language, that are still doing our political work. Like the other day, I got this message from someone in rural India, in South India, who said, "I've never seen anyone with a body that looks like yours. I don't understand your poetry because you speak English too fast, but like, are you a girl or a boy or what are you?" And it's this really exciting moment for me because it was like less about what we're actually saying, but also what it means to inhabit a stage or a platform of visibility as like visibly gender nonconforming people, and especially as visibly gender nonconforming South Asians, because so much of our assimilation within this settler colonial project has been about our integration into the gender binary.
And into heteropatriarchy.
What are some other challenges that you've come across in your work, and how have you navigated them?
In our artwork specifically?
Yeah.
So many.
So many.
Okay. Well, I think that we sort of alluded before at how we have this critique of the art world. I think we always really have an issue on how to narrate ourselves, like what we're doing. Because when we sort of talk about what we're doing, it's just kind of like our lies. But then there's the politics of like how you write a bio.
You have to write the bio, like, and the artist description.
Yeah, and how you locate yourself disciplinary. Like, are you a spoken word artist? Are you a fashionista? Like, what are you? What's going on?
And I think that if we're going to really inhabit those, you know, non-binary politics, we're really not that binary of spoken word artist or fashionista. We're all of those things.
Yeah.
So our art form uses they and them pronouns. So we sometimes, amongst ourselves and I guess with our friends, we talk about how if we extended the LGBTQPIA, etc. acronym, we would be the W, because we're the weirdos. Because I think, all other identities aside, we're also just really weird. And that, I think, is what makes us particularly hard to put down an artist bio.
It's just kind of hard to inhabit the normative world more generally.
like, make small talk.
Yeah. Art is just kind of like our way of doing group therapy.
We should ask people to just bring us to dinner parties. Yeah. I think that'd be really fun.
I think another creative challenge that we face, too, is like, we're really committed to building social movements. Yeah. And we recognize that capitalism and neoliberalism are more committed to building celebrities rather than movements, and building moments and not movements. And people often mistake the consumption of our art form, and by people, I'll say white cis allies, will often mistake like reading a Dark Matter poem or going to a show as the rev. Like,
oh, we recently found out that people were using Dark Matter to find each other on Tinder, which is an online dating app. If they were like mutually into Dark Matter, like, oh, we have some shared politic. Anyway, which is sort of a dream, but also,
yeah. But there's this way in which, like, I feel like everything that we try to do politically gets co-opted in the system, right? So we're saying, like, let's build movements. Don't just consume our art or our sort of abstract or aesthetic away from our social movement.
And then it's like, oh my God, I just went to a Dark Matter show.
Yeah, right? And there's this way in which liberalism swallows us no matter what we're doing. I feel like it always, we call it the liberal cyborg.
It's like the blue whale in Finding Nemo. And we're just like these little plankton.
Yeah. So sometimes it can feel challenging because like if you really like read what we're saying very simple things like be nice, like organize, like redistribute
Make
capital.
Make sure that people have all their needs met.
Yeah. Like
basic things.
And then people will just like make that into an aesthetic. And it's like, actually, no, like we're talking about real people's lives, and how do we remember that like our art and most artists that we sort of subscribe or are part of are really linked to people who are struggling. And the reason that Jenny and I are here is because of our privileges. One of the things we always say is that the best artists are the people who have been forcibly silenced. So we're doing this for the people who we're not hearing from. So I think it can feel sort of jarring to enter art spaces where we're just kind of like, okay, everyone, like let's actually like after this art show, like go, like, have a rally, you know? Like, how do we inform people? That sort of work.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us on No One Is Legal Radio.
Thanks for having us.
What a cool show.
Yeah.